Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
I'm opening.
We have
an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another Anatomy of a Movie. This week, we are speaking about Room, and from a very small room itself. I'm John Comerford, joined in the studio by Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody.
And Dimitri Carlos.
Hello, movie fans. Yeah, I was just actually, if the four of us were stuck in this room,
yeah,
it would be,
yeah, for 7 years.
What's that royale? Battle royale.
Well, we do have a couch.
Four people go in, one comes out.
One comes out.
Beyond Thunderdome. So, first of all, we want to welcome Tamara. Welcome you to the
podcast. Last time
Have you on the panel.
Was, the way, way back.
Way, way back.
I think they're the same
way,
crew.
Way, way back. Way, way back. All
right.
Yeah.
So,
welcome.
Yes. Well. And as we always do, let's jump right in with our overall thoughts of the movie. Marissa, why don't you start? I know that you really wanted to do this podcast. You were really looking forward to it. In fact, it was the strength of you wanting to do this that we chose to do it.
I was relentless. I was like, we have to talk about Room.
So jump in. What was your why? Why were you so animated about this?
You know, because, you know, this movie premiered at Toronto Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, following I was following the film circuit, and everyone was talking about Room. And I was like, I gotta watch this, you know, I gotta know more about it. And then when it came out, and I saw Brie Larson was in it, I mean, she's great. And I finally saw it back in October 2015, and I was like, we have to do this. We have to talk about it. And sure enough, like, it was so limited that no one saw it. I was like, I was so adamant about watching this because I even looked up showtimes. I was like, here you guys go. Go to these theaters. That's when they're showing it. That's how much
she
I wanted it.
So, like,
everyone
situation,
had opportunity to go see it. So, long story short, like, I really, really enjoyed this movie, and I loved how realistic it felt. And the sad realization that this can actually happen, and it has happened in real life, is it's scary to watch, but it was scary but beautiful to watch on screen. And to see it portrayed in a way that you just have all the feels,
so
more so.
For you, was
end.
It the movie itself, or was it the story, or both? Or what was it that was so intriguing to you that said, we have to do this?
I think it was the story and the emotion that I felt at the end of it, that I wanted to share just what that experience could be like with anyone else, and talking about it and, like, working through an issue that it is important to have interactions with people, where she was so limited for 7 years. It's like, what could that feel like? And I feel like it would be best to talk to someone about that and have a whole panel to talk about this.
And was that your feeling at the end, is that you just wanted to talk to other people, or did you have a feeling of, was it a life-affirming movie? What was the feeling you got at the end of this?
I was amazed by the performance and what I felt at the end of it. It was riveting emotionally, and I love emotionally driven movies.
I feel like you were maybe locked in a room for a while.
She saw it in a very tiny room. She saw it for 2 hours. Tamara, what did you
think? 2 hours.
Overall, I really liked the film. Mm-hmm. When I first heard about it on the radio, and the very first conversation people were having was about the performance of Brie Larson, more than any anything other else. Sort of impression of the film. And then, as you say, came out in pretty limited release, even here in Los Angeles, and a very dear friend of mine, who I almost always agree with on films, recommended it to me. And even though I am a great lover of true crime,
you could just send it
literally
there.
Watch.
You could just send it there.
Yeah, stop. I watch Dateline every day because I've always been intrigued
the true
by
crime
that
stuff.
Yeah, and so, you know, when I knew at least some of the subject matter was about, you know, something like that, I thought, well, this is up my alley. But you know, films are so much more intense. I was a little concerned about, you know, the pain of it, essentially. Mm-hmm. And this friend of mine said, she said, you know, I have to say it's one of my most favorite movies of the year. And for her to say that, she's a very tender heart, I thought, well, this is going to be something that's different than what I might be used to in certain movie-going experiences. And so when I finally did see it, there was so much that I loved about it. The performances, obviously, which we'll talk about. Knowing as I do, because it's a hobby of mine, about these, you know, weird criminals and things and serial killers and all that. It was so interesting to see it from a more, personal view. And as Marissa says, kind of watch the evolving of, how the characters got through this trauma. I just think is fascinating.
Okay. Dimitri.
Yeah, well, my intro to The Room was a little bit of a combination of both. I first heard of it from Marissa way back. It could have been in October or so when she started talking about it. And then similar because of other people talking about it. Brie Larson's performance seems to overshadow. If anything, it's Brie Larson's performance seems to overshadow everything else about about first learning about the picture. And so, yeah, and it came out, you know, it was extremely limited. And I had heard from friends who had seen it at film festivals saying that it's an interesting movie. It's sort of a hard one to take, but there's, it ends hopefully in a sense. So, you know, that's all good and fine. So when I finally got around to seeing it, there was already this hype sort of kind of going in there. And I think it's a very well put together film. I think it's a very solid film. It's definitely a movie that stands on the shoulders of its two lead actors. They carry the movie, they carry the, you know, the entire, 2 hours or so. So they were perfectly cast and they were perfect in these roles. If one was a weak link, this movie would not have worked. I thought it was a very solid movie. I thought it was directed really well. But I don't think it's – I didn't think it was, like, best picture movie. I had to think to myself – well, there are a couple of things. If the category were only five movies instead of 10, would this have made the grade? And then I'm looking at the director going – yes, he did a very good job, but was his job better than Ridley Scott? Did he have, like, what did, you know, the movie's emotional. I did have a thing, the ending, towards the end, I sort of kind of was like, nah, I don't think so. Like, I don't know who would advise that, but it still, you know, was, it still had hope, which I really liked. That was my favorite part because this
movie needed a little sunshine.
Yeah, well, you know, this movie could have gone the other way. I mean, I never read the book, you know, so it's an adaptation.
Yeah, we should check that. Yeah. Has anybody read the book on this panel?
No, have not. No.
Does anybody know about the book? Meaning, yes. I know the how it differs from the movie. Does anybody know
that? I do not know.
I know a little bit.
It's relatively close. So, but I'm like, you know, that this movie could have gone, you know, another way. This could have gone like the way of a Seven or something. It could have been a darker movie, which I'm glad it wasn't. So all in all, I think it's a very solid film. It's definitely worth a view, especially now that Brie Larson's nominated. I think it's worth seeing for her, and I think it's worth seeing for the little boy
Jacob
Tremblay. Although I don't necessarily think it was a bad thing that he didn't get nominated. There's no need to ruin that kid's life as of yet. I think he's young and has a way to go, but he did a really good job. And I think in part, well, in a large part, and we'll talk about it later, his performance was like, this is what a good director can do with a child, because they really had to, not coax, but they had to manipulate a good performance out of him because he's only, what?
He's
only
seven or eight at the time.
Yeah.
So, playing five-year-old.
Yeah, and the relationship, too. Brie Larson, like, they felt like mother and son. And I think that's where Brie Larson's performance, like, really shined through. Like, she has the mother instinct, you know? So she's going to make a good mom. She is. She's going to make a good, at least she could act it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh, goodness. Your thoughts, John? Okay, yes, overall impressions. I echo all of you, everything. Now, moving on.
No.
Well, jeez, it took a long time to get there. So. I thought it was a really good movie. I have my own relationship with it, but they're minor. Yes, I enjoyed the performances. I thought those were terrific. I'm just fascinated that the movie got made, because, you know, it's nice to see when a movie that is just character-driven and story-driven, it's
yes.
very small, mm-hmm. that gets nice attention, and I, you know, appreciate that because that's the kind of films we're trying to make.
Right, exactly. So,
that's a good thing. But what I wanted to turn to was the difference between the book. Now, since none of us have read the book, we can't speak too much to it, although I believe it's all written from
the
Jack's
boys.
Point of view.
Yeah. Jack's point of view.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I thought that obviously they chose not to do that in the movie, you know, and they didn't use a voiceover. They didn't use it throughout. They obviously used it to some degree. But did you like that change? Because, you know, for me, a lot of it, you know, especially the second half, is Mom's point of view. It becomes Ma's story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So did you guys think that was a good idea, a bad idea? Well, would you have rather seen it from the kid's point of view the entire time?
I mean, to that point, I think even, you know, while doing the research, they said when they were at Room, mm-hmm. they purposely shot it from more so the boy's perspective. Mm-hmm. And then when they left it, they shot it from the adult perspective because they wanted to keep the essence of what it would be, that mentality of seeing Room, the only world that mm-hmm. Jack knew. Like what he saw from the room, and you definitely in such tight little quarters,
right.
It felt like that. But I don't think that deterred anything from the directing. When I clearly understood what we should be feeling at certain points throughout the film.
Yeah, well, Lenny Abramson himself too said, "Look, the novel has the boy's voice, but we've got his face, and that's right. what you have to." That's what you have to separate. You have to separate the inner. How many times have we seen a book to screen mm-hmm. where a lot of it's the inner thoughts of the mm-hmm. characters? It's hard to do.
Right. The one that I think of is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Mm-hmm. And did you read the book?
No.
Okay. It's all written, and it's. I call it Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close, and Terribly Sad. but I think that was because the thing is that you've got words. It's words, 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 words
right.
in a book, and completely different medium, obviously, film. And you have to come up with creative ways to convey that, like being on
Jack's
his face yeah. and, you no. know, coming from Ma's face for other things, because it just can't be conveyed in the same way that words are in a novel.
Yeah, and to have overvoice, it could have been oversaturated. And again, I think, you know, especially with today's movies, I sort of kind of enjoy it when they can pick up a nuance of an actor's face, like where they convey an emotion or a feeling or a... you know, or a nod that conveys movement or something like that. And that's what this movie captures very well. Lenny Abrams was able to do that with both of his lead actors. You know, and I think, too, that it helps when you have Brie Larson, who really fell into this role, who really filled up the role of motherhood. When you have the boy who's at 7 and very impressionable, I just got the sense that he really did look up to her, like as another mom, as someone to look up to as an adult figure. And I think that bond really worked because, again, you could have let other devices tell this story. I don't think it would have been as captivating or as emotional. Had you done it any other way?
Well, speaking of that, Tammy, you've done some research on the fact that they chose not to do any flashbacks or anything, but just to stay right in that.
Yeah, that had a lot to do with the author mm-hmm. who wrote the book as well as the screenplay, Emma Donoghue. That had a lot to do with her choices. And mm-hmm. she really didn't want to use the trick, the device of flashbacks and voiceover
yeah.
and things like that to convey it. Which I think is fascinating, being a person who's both written the novel and the screenplay, mm-hmm. there's a shift that has to happen
yeah.
in order to be able to do that. And she really understood that it has to be looked at as a completely different incarnation mm-hmm. of your story.
And it lets the audience, too. I felt the screenplay lets the audience come to conclusions, right conclusions. Like, it's not like it's a mystery.
Yeah.
But it lets the audience come to conclusions about, like, who the boy is, who Jack is, how this happened, why, you know. And the way it's sort of kind of pieced together, because you don't know if they were kidnapped together or something. Mm-hmm. But then it's just, you know, through directing and just little nuances, you know, oh, okay. We know who the father is in this movie, so it doesn't beat the audience over the head, and you know, it allows the audience to come to its conclusions, which are the right, like, you know, it doesn't mislead you, it doesn't play like a noir mystery.
No.
But I think as an audience, you sort of come to the conclusions at the same time when you're supposed to.
Yeah, right? I think it's smart that there wasn't any flashbacks, because if it is coming from the boy's perspective, he is so young, it'd be kind of hard for him to visually show a young kid's memories with flashbacks with so little knowledge that he has in life. And then, again, for just storytelling and revealing exposition, I thought that was very smart that we got it from Ma. Like, later down the line, like, what actually happened to her and how she got into that predicament.
Yeah, we can all, but wouldn't you say that the conventional wisdom would be, we're going to be locked up in a room for half this movie? No. Most storytellers, most filmmakers would say, we got to do something to break that up. It's going to be too boring. It's going to be too challenging for an audience, whatever. And they would do the flashbacks to show where she came from, what happened to her, how she got, all those kinds of things. They would intersperse those or in some way cut them in just to come out of that room for a while. Don't you think that's how it would go?
Yes, but just to continue that
conventionally.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
The other thing is that Emma Donahue really and Lenny Abramson really wanted to convey the claustrophobia.
Yeah.
And that was her specific choice, was I didn't want any of those, you know, dream sequences or any of that stuff to break up the claustrophobia
You can't have a room as a world if you keep going outside that
correct.
World.
Mm-hmm.
So, but let's speak of it, because you mentioned claustrophobia. I was talking to you earlier.
Yeah.
And I was saying, you know, it's so odd to me that I didn't feel claustrophobic in the room. And I don't know if that's a good thing or bad thing. But every once in a while, as I was watching it, I go, why am I not feeling that this is so tiny? It's only a 10 by 10 room or whatever it is, 11 by 11.
You know, did that bother you?
Well, it did in a sense. I mean, I understand what he was doing, because I did do some research about why he shot with what lenses and things like that. But I never got from, you know, I know it's from a kid's perspective in the sense that first half is. So I get that in his world, it is what it is. It's not big, it's not small. It's just, this is his world. But every once in a while, especially as we got into that, I wanted to feel the claustrophobia too. I mean, this is a small room and it's not that big. And I'm going, I didn't feel that. And I went, at some point, I wanted to.
Mm-hmm. See, I kind of get that. I mean, visually, I got the claustrophobic, but every time Ma and Jack were together by themselves, there was just a sense of calm and peace. Like throughout most of
except
the scenes,
except when he wanted his candles.
Most of the time they're having fun. They're having like a nice mother,
sure, it's playtime, yeah.
Mother son time. And then the only panic and nervousness that actually came into that room was every time old Nick came in. Got that sense of danger.
Mm-hmm.
So, but every time they were by themselves, it felt calm. So it didn't feel claustrophobic. It just felt like two guys or two people in a room.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, and I agree with both your points, because again, I didn't feel that sense of like being in a lot like a closet,
right? Yeah.
And I think because it was pretty set on that this is the kids' universe, mm-hmm. and from the kids' perspective, it went to me like nurture nature. Like, mm-hmm. and this is his nature. Like, this is what he's used to.
Yeah.
Like, he's never seen really anything else, which begged the question, like, how did all that birthing go down? And where? And who
right
did that?
There,
and
what? Apparently.
But okay. All right. But so this kid grows up in this environment.
Yeah.
And this is all he knows. Where we get the sense of claustrophobia is only from Ma. She's the one that gets on edge at certain times.
Yeah,
she's outside of
and she would be
old
the only
Nick
one would
coming
know.
In, and she's the one that really you,
you
know,
can only have a sense of claustrophobia right. if you know that there's something down
right.
there.
Yeah, she knows that there's and yeah. she's having a hard time. And, you know, I really enjoyed the thing talking about TV because
mm-hmm.
again, yeah. like. To
how do you
Jack,
explain
like,
that?
Yeah.
And like, he's obviously figured out a way.
TV.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's also the physical elements of the room. They had food. They had mm-hmm. toys. They had a TV. So it felt like those are normal day things that we see every mm-hmm. every single day that, you know, you put it in a room, it seems like a normal life.
Mm-hmm. So did you, any of you get the sense that it was that small, that, I mean, that room was that confined? Did you get that feeling when you were in the, watching it in the audience?
Or? I got the sense of confined and small, mm-hmm. but I didn't get the sense of the claustrophobia.
Yeah. I agree with that. I feel the same way, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know,
the heft of that door. The door.
Yeah, exactly.
Door bothered me.
The heft of that door.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The heft of the door. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. And I like that it's been explained that he shot with somewhat longer lenses to create that depth of field so that when he wanted to be intimate with the people, the walls would go away, they'd be blurry in the background, so you'd just be with those characters. And when he wanted a sense of how small the room was, he'd shoot with the wider lenses so you could see both corners and stuff like that. But even with that, I mean, I get it intellectually. I just didn't feel it emotionally. I didn't feel it that it was anyway, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to bring up, because you were talking about a little bit of the cinematographer who, yeah. Danny Cohen, who we talked about, who did the Danish Girl. And
speech,
it's really interesting is that he used the same exact camera. Mm-hmm. He used the same camera for both movies, mm-hmm. yet he used the two different lenses.
Right.
And the one that you were referring to is a Panavision Primos, and that definitely has, it's a lot more contrastier, he says. And he using Kino flows, which is more akin to fluorescent lighting, gave the room a texture and a look, and it gave it sort of kind of that blue in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from the way that they filmed, you know, by putting the lens all, like flush of the wall where the camera would be on the other side of the wall, mm-hmm. you know, they built a sound stage for this. And so the camera, the lens would be in the wall, like a hole in the wall, in a sense. That's how we're looking at it. Cameras behind it. I found that interesting. Lights that went up about six or so stories so that they can get proper lighting.
Let's add to this, because Tamara, I'm sure you might have it in your notes as well about the stage and how it was built. And
yeah, so the production designer, Ethan Taubman, talked about proposing that the room itself be approached like a Rubik's Cube, but inverted. So the world is inside the Rubik's Cube.
Mm-hmm.
And so every, surface of the room.
Every wall, every ceiling. And
was
the ceiling
1 foot tiles. So the ceiling, the floor, I mean, generally speaking, you know. So there's actually in Variety a photo of, I think it's the scene where Jack is lying on the rug and they're rehearsing that moment.
The escape.
And Ma's hanging over him. There's actually a photo. I don't know if you have it there, but there's a trap underneath the
floor. So one of the panels is missing.
Correct. And they're shooting up so you can see directly part of Jack's head and Ma's face in the shot. But all, you know, you're all still within that same confines of this 10x10 room.
So normally, instead of building a set where walls can be removed, they decided, let's break that down even farther. Let's just have panels of walls being able to, so either 1 foot, 1 square foot of wall being able to be removed at a time for a camera or light or whatever it may be, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so they talked about how it allowed for production to maintain a rule that every shot be achievable within the space, inside that cube, and the camera would be outside poking through, which created incredible challenges for the production crew.
Yeah, but I imagine it would have been much better for the actors, because you don't have all these people staring at you.
Yeah. And I know that they removed walls when necessary, but not overly. So I actually thought they were using certain pen light type of lenses.
Oh, is that right?
Like, you know, because, you know, or some type of something small that would go. I mean, that would have seemed to might have been a good idea as well. Maybe they approached that and felt this was the better way. But it was obviously you could
I think the idea of doing the panels and just – I think that was a great idea, because really, because you are creating that environment for those two people to get the performance that everybody's been lauding.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that how could that not enhance it? Because it's, to some degree, you will forget everything's there. Because first of all, you can't see it for the most part. You can't feel it, because it's just one little thing that's missing. And then when you're doing the scene – it goes away completely. I can only imagine that added to the intimacy and to the performances in whole. I mean, how could it not?
One of the other things that it allowed was that they could do two cameras running a scene. Mm-hmm. So they would really be sure to get every nuance of those performances, which I'm sure is part of why it looks so good on
camera. And when you're working with children and when you shoot 6 hours a day, whatever it is, I mean, I'm sure that helps.
I
think it's great that, you know, they actually, you know, they kept it to those confines because while watching it, I figured, you know, they were collapsible walls or removable walls, like the normal shooting.
Which they were.
Yeah, somewhere. But when I was, you know, doing more research a few months ago, I tried my best to look up this video again. But I saw a time-lapse video. There is a video out there in the world.
Oh, wow.
There's a time-lapse video of the men who actually constructed the wall and like the whole room itself within a day. And I'm like, wow, there was only a 10 by 10 room.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a testament to the filming that they actually went those lengths to get that raw emotional feeling that we got out of the performance of everybody.
I think the editing too, like, really helps. And that for the most part, the movie was filmed chronologically. Yeah. You know, as well. You know, I think all of those factors, again, we always talk about how things can click. Mm-hmm. And in this movie, you know, between the production design, you know, between cinematography, the cameras that were being used, how this movie was edited, because the movie is two halves. You know, it's inside and then it's outside. And how are you going to convey? And from an editing standpoint, you know, the editor, Nathan Nugent, had said, you know, the first part, he goes, it was about these two characters together, but I had to construct like a separation, like when we're getting outside of the room. And how do we work on bigger rooms, so to speak? Because once they were in the outside world, when they're in a house,
they still felt small.
Yeah.
Well, to some degree, they were still confined by their circumstance. I mean, let's face it, they couldn't even leave the house without the paparazzi or whatever. So they were in a bigger room.
It was interesting in how they had to create like tension and how to do this, especially when they're not inside that room anymore.
And speaking of being inside that room.
Yeah, the production crew talked about the director talked about how after they basically spent a month filming inside that space, and they were all going stir crazy.
The crew. And there's a 70-person crew, I think?
Not all of them in the room at one time, but it was 70 people on the crew, and they just kept going, come on, 3 more days and we'll be out, 2 more days and we'll be out, 1 more day and we'll be out, and then we'll be out on the streets and in the world. And then when they did get out on the Toronto freezing cold winter streets, the traffic, the hassles, all of that, they found themselves
not being in control of the environment.
Weirdly, like the characters, longing for the simple, regular world of Room. And he said, I mean, it's so ironic, but it came as a big surprise to all of them that they would have a similar experience, that culture shock, you know?
Saying that I'd experienced that on a couple of shoots where we've been in one location for so long, you can't wait to get out. And you just say, please, let's be over with this.
And he spent time in the bathtub, a lot of time in the bathtub.
You're talking about the director.
The director, not you. Like not you. Yes. Because it was one place where he could be right on set, be close in proximics with all the actors without being obtrusive. And so he'd pop up and give notes, and then pop back down again. Because it was the one place.
Spent a lot of time in the bathtub, did you?
A lot of time in the tub.
I directed from the bathtub.
The plumbing money. I directed from the bathtub. Was it a coal?
And he took his daily bath there, too. So it was very
efficient.
Yeah.
It's efficient. And it saved on production.
Multitasking.
Yeah. You bet.
So I wanted to talk a little bit further about the fact that it was in two halves, so to speak, and that the structure of it. We were in the room for half of it, and then finally get to escape. Well, roughly half. The one thing that I felt about the second half of it is almost as if, well, I shouldn't say it this way. Let me just say it this way. I felt like Jack was kind of like pushed aside a little bit. His story, I should say, not physically or anything like that, but we really were kind of what's happening to Ma here, and I get that and everything like that. But I wanted. I just felt like we were tracking one way, and then we just fizzled out that way. Does anybody else feel that, or were you all right?
I mean, I can understand that, but also because Jack hasn't lived in the world, it would, in a way, make sense that that type of perspective and point of view would come back to the mother. And just for kids in general, kids have an easier are, you know, more easy to be adaptable to different situations. So, like, the fact that throughout the film we saw Jack, like, now starting to play with other people and, like, not really being as affected as a grown-up mm-hmm. would be, that I felt believable because kids can assimilate faster.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that – I agree with you that I believe that kids can mm-hmm. adapt easier in a situation. But – and it didn't bother me that the focus went more to mom. I mean, she was the – you know, she was the more mature. She was in there. She knew how she got mm-hmm. in there. And while we're in the room, there wasn't – correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, it wasn't like Jack – that was Jack's world. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know of abuse mm-hmm. and being captured and being mm-hmm. put – that was his world. That was his normal. Mm-hmm. So coming outside of that, you know, I just felt, yeah, as resilient as a kid can be, like his new normal and adaptability, you know, I found it interesting. He was able to adapt where Ma mm-hmm. was having a really hard time adapting because she felt that she was losing her, like,
well, she knows there's trauma. And, she's right, aware of what
trauma, felt that she was becoming distant with her son, like in mm-hmm. that room. She had nobody else to talk yeah. to except for old Nick. And we know.
And in the room, all she was right. was Ma.
Right.
So but outside. No, I get all
given her basic freedoms again, I think it makes sense to go to, again, sort of kind of shift the focus back to Ma.
And I agree with that as well. I think my point was that I just felt like the balance was off for me. I think all that stuff is true. I just felt like after a while, it's like, it would have been almost as if he disappeared from the show.
Mm.
It's like, oh, cause, and not that you didn't see him, and not that, and I agree with you that you would understand why he would assimilate easier or that he would overcome these things. Like, all that's true, but I just went, no, I guess we're just going to talk about Mom now.
It's interesting, though, that you say that because to me, Jack didn't disappear from the show. Mm-hmm. Even though Ma was going through her issues, mm-hmm. Jack was going through, well, freedom. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. there were scenes where, you know, he was introduced to the dog mm-hmm. and walking the dog. There were many scenes with Jack without Ma, which I found. And so, like, he didn't disappear. For me, he didn't disappear.
But it didn't disappear. I'm just saying, after a while, if I could trace the arc, it would go like this. And then all those things, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. But the emotional impact of that, it was like, it was so much easier that I go, what happened to his conflict? It was so easy. Like, oh, okay, he's not talking. Oh, now he is talking. Mm-hmm. Oh, he has a dog. Oh, but now he's okay with it. It was just too easy, where Mom's just got harder and harder. Mm. And to me, that balance, for me, was off. I don't disagree with anything you're mm-hmm. saying other than I wanted a little bit more, because the kid was so good.
A little more struggle.
Yes, it just seemed too easy for me.
What was so interesting for me, though, to speak to that, is that every time he would encounter a new experience, mm-hmm. I was concerned for him. Mm-hmm. Like, is there going to be jeopardy here? Is he mm-hmm. going to be, you know, bitten by the dog because he doesn't know what dogs do? Is mm-hmm. he going to, you know, be taken by a stranger because he doesn't know that strangers can do that? You know, I felt like there was jeopardy there for him. But I guess you're more talking about his own internal struggle, yes. not our struggle no. with him.
Yeah, again, since he had no concept of evil, of what put him in the room to begin with,
yeah.
I think it just for me, it again, his resilience, his able to assimilate was just easier. He didn't have, he wasn't kidnapped off the street. And that was an interesting thing, too. As I said earlier before, the movie brings you to the conclusion as to who Jack is. But prior to that, you know, when the movie first opens, I was like, who is this kid? Like, did he kidnap, is he really her son?
Right.
Did he kidnap two different people and he just wanted to have his own idea of a family? Yeah. Like, how did this happen? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as the story goes along, you're like, oh, okay. All right. So how's this going to play out? And and then it plays out a little bit later on, you know, when William H. Macy you know, shows up.
Right.
And Joan Allen. And
I think he appears. I don't think you can say he shows up.
A couple key moments in the
movie. Now, is that lack of balance also there because maybe you didn't get the sense of struggle for Ma in the room in the first half.
No, I got her struggle. Although I have to say there were moments I wanted to see. I thought it was great when Jack says, let's, I think she says, he says, let's break the skylight away.
Right.
She goes, no, Mommy, try that. That's why Tony's right. me. Those kinds of, I wanted a little bit more of that.
Yeah.
I wanted just a little bit more of what she's already been through. Just, and I'm not saying a lot. It's not like we had to go through the litany of things that she's tried to get out. But it, and I also was hoping
she lost the toilet seat.
I was thinking that it would be nice to have them, as a game, figure out ways to escape or something like that. But because the plan she came up with, I'm sure she'd been thinking about it for years. Because, you know, she's probably, I don't know how many things she's tried, but we can assume that she's tried some things. But it was almost like I wanted something like that because in a way, it felt a little bit out of, like, oh my God, we have to go now because the power set up, or he's lost a job and we may be dead at any minute.
He may kill us.
He may kill us.
Yeah.
And I'm going, hadn't you been thinking that for 7 years?
Well, yeah.
So anyway, I wanted a little run up to that, like, because it would have been interesting that they created this game. No, we'll try this, and it would have been all a game until it's not a game.
Can we?
Because he was so frightened by the whole thing, and I thought you would have prepped him sooner. But maybe, yeah. I mean, that's just second guessing, because who knows? I'm not in that situation. I don't know what I would do. But anyway, that was just my thought on that.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up that for 7 years, I mean, I don't know, you would figure death could come at any day or any moment or anything.
Yeah.
But what I found interesting about old Nick is they actually showed his face. And a lot of movies, they wouldn't have shown the evil's face.
Right.
Okay. It would have been an unknown. So it could have been anybody. But they actually went.
Yeah.
I was like, so they're going to show his face. They, you know, like.
And did you like that? I think it would have been scarier not to. Not that scarier, just like, again, that's where I wanted to go back to the child POV, where we're looking through the closet. When I would just, maybe a glancing look at it, but it's just kind of like, now that, I don't know, it took away something for me from the experience. Did not want to see his face.
All
right.
I liked when they established old Nick. The first shot we saw was from the closet, distorted type of view. And the first line, practically, he says, like, do you want candy? You know, don't ever take candy from strangers. Like, that's bad. So they really established just, you know, how scary he is and what he can and what he brought to the room. But also later on when they actually showed his face and he was delivering his lines, he's saying, like, it came from the perspective that, like, he wasn't getting satisfaction in the world. He's like, I'm doing all this and, like, not happy that people aren't, you know, acknowledging all the work, so-called, that he's putting into everything. So in a way, I didn't really feel for him, but I understood where he was coming from. It was like that self-pity that he always has.
Sure, but, you know,
and
I
then
think
it kind of just made him more human.
That was probably why they did that, because the face of evil, because any person, it could be just some regular Joe.
Absolutely.
And
I think it added to the complication.
Yeah.
I'm sure it did. I'm just saying from my vantage point in the audience, I didn't want to see it because, for me, it detracted from the experience of it. I agree. It's a wonderful argument to make that, no, the face of evil could be anybody or whatever it is.
And
he's just some regular Joe, but it didn't add to the depth.
But I liked
the
reveal of
the
face, too, because, you know, it's established that he's a quote-unquote monster, right? So, you know, he's not Michael Myers, so it's not like he has an expressionless face. And when we finally see him, like, you're going, he looks normal. Like, he looks
like
your
next door neighbor.
No,
and that's the other thing.
I think there's an element of this is not a thriller. And so we're not trying to make him scary. This is, you know, I mean, ultimately, everyone's talking, the makers, filmmakers talk about how this is a movie about a mother and a son. And it's not a thriller.
Yeah.
And because as an audience, especially me, is so conditioned with, you know, crime movies and horror movies and scary movies. If we don't see his face, it could be that he's going to show up later, you know, because that's kind of how we think when we're thinking movies.
I'm sure there are all kinds of conversations about should we show him, should we not show him, what are the reasons to, what are the reasons not to. And I agree with everything you're saying, that by showing him, you're saying, you know, that you're taking that onus off that. But I think it would have been just as interesting. For me, it would have been more interesting if with his voice, he was just this regular guy, and you're going, and that would have made me going, what the hell? But I just think it would be, for me, it would have been more intriguing, more interesting without seeing his face. I still would have had what he said, how he said it, how he behaved with her. That would have given me all the stuff about what a regular guy he was when he got violent and almost killed her. All those kinds of things. I just, as I saw his face, I went, ah, crap.
No.
It just detracted from me.
I want to layer on top of something you had said about, and this was actually one of my sort of kind of, one of my little issues with the movie, is that, number one, they set up, he was such a presence that, yes, ultimately the story is about Ma and Jack and overcoming this ordeal. And in a sense, it's a very unorthodox coming-of-age story. Okay, so I get that. But since there was this outside force, this monster, so to speak, who actually, you know, who had this influence over them, who put this in this predicament, you know, at the end, I sort of kind of would have liked to know that this guy was sent away for, and was like, I would have, I know it's not a crime story, I get that. But I still
your
like
sense of justice wanted it.
Yeah. Well, it did because it was set up so much in the beginning that this guy is just—he's not a good. He's bad. He's evil. Old Nick's is a term for the devil. Yeah. So he is the devil, and he gets caught. I wanted, in one way, shape, or form, to know
you
what his comeuppance was. I didn't have to see it. Just. To tell me that the guy was put on death row or something.
I know. I found that to be a very common criticism. I had a relatively heated conversation with somebody I saw that movie with about that because he was going on and on. Sorry, everyone. That, you know, I wanted to go into the courtroom, and much more than what you're talking about.
No.
But I wanted to go into the courtroom. I wanted to know. And I said, no, because it's not that kind of movie. It's not what that's about. I do understand, you know, the nodding to it. And
I didn't need a courtroom drama.
Right.
But it's not that. You said it right from the. It's not that kind of a movie. But since this individual had such bearing on these two people's lives, and it was so evil, and that he had so much control by shutting off power that he basically was his imposing himself on these people that they became who they are, and they had their struggles. I wanted some, even if it was a throwaway line, even if it was something in the news in the background, so and so. You know, Nick,
didn't he get arrested?
Yes,
that was it. We just saw him getting carted away.
See the result.
That's the end result. Well, the movie didn't go that long.
And you know, as somebody,
trial would take years.
Anyway. Right. Well, that's part
in
of the
end,
practicality
it was
of it.
Yeah.
And as we've already established, I'm somebody who's fascinated by this stuff. I was okay about not knowing it because I trusted that
that's not
the other thing that I trusted is that it didn't matter.
Well, that's what I thought was interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I got that part too.
But it didn't matter because they prevailed.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And once they were out of there,
I agree
they didn't
with
care
that
about
him. Camera because, you know, I watched
but
so
did
much.
They, I mean, but that's my thing.
Well, they prevailed in the sense that they got away.
Well, they got away.
But they got him.
Yeah, they got him, but I was even as a victim, I think a victim. Like, here's the thing. I don't think. Like, when they went back to the shed at the end of the movie, I was like, no. No.
You don't think they'd go back?
No, I don't see any therapist.
Don't you always gotta go back to where you grew up?
Yes. Actually,
I don't see any therapist saying that that would be a good idea.
Yeah, no.
Like, go ahead, Ma. Go back to, cause she knew. Like, I don't see that.
Wait,
you
I don't get that. So you,
back in.
Well, I don't know that they consulted a therapist before, prior
but
to that.
Actually,
well,
Brie Larson did talk to a trauma specialist. Yeah. But to that point, Dimitri, I was actually kind of more satisfied with the fact that she went back to the room and got somewhat of a closure. Like, all right, we're and now closing the book on this chapter. Because it also just reminded me of, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of the book, A Child Called It. Well, quick preface that it's about a boy who was abused by his mother for years and grew up and finally got out of that horrible situation. But he finally went back to the house.
How many years?
He was an adult at this time. But
that's not the case here.
No. I know. Yeah. But in this film, I was just more surprised at the fact that she went back so soon. I could believe later on down the road, years, that she would go back and get closure. I was more surprised at the fact how soon that happened.
That's the thing that I was like, I mean, and you're right. Like, had it said something like 10 years gone by and you go back to the neighborhood and it's completely changed or whatever, it's like not the same, and that maybe that shit wouldn't have existed. But I'm like, yeah, it's a little too soon for someone. Like, she was really traumatized. Traumatized to the point that she attempted suicide. So I'm like, yeah, I can't see that being a good idea. And as a victim, I would, again, I don't want to harp on it too much, but that was one thing. I was looking for closure on old Nick. Just a little bit. Again, I didn't want a courtroom drama.
She was too. That's why she went back.
Yeah.
But could be the argument, yeah.
Yeah. But she didn't. What was the... I just wanted to know, like, did he get death row? Was he raped
he did.
In prison?
Yeah. He did.
Let's say he
should have gotten
until he went
all
to the electric
that
chair.
Stuff. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but he did.
I was okay with not seeing it because, you know, I watched so much Criminal Minds and, you know, Law and Order. But it's like, I always know that they got them in the end. I don't need to see the whole process of, like,
I
just, like, the satisfaction, like, yeah, they got him.
Let me be clear. I don't need to see that. Yeah. I just wanted to hear something.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. I get it.
Except that would just mean we'd have to have the movie go on because it'd be years down the line again. So you're saying we needed to have a time jump.
No. All I'm saying is at the end...
But you already know he's arrested.
He's in jail. He got raped in jail and he's dead. That's it. Done. Boom. There you go. Over and over. Yay. He got karma. There you go.
Karma. Dahmer scenario.
There you go. Done.
All right.
One throwaway line or television in the background.
Or newspaper clipping.
Yay!
There you go.
Well, I think that's really interesting because a lot of people have said that because they opened that door. And for those people that had that righteous indignation, they wanted that and stuff. And the filmmakers were very clear that they wanted that's not what the film was about. The film was about child and the child-mother bond and what it's like to leave that bond and what happens when things go wrong and things, you know, what happens to
them.
So
and reconnecting.
That was not part of their story structure.
Yeah.
No. But they, other people, since they opened that can of worms, they wanted it resolved.
Yeah.
So, but you guys didn't. I didn't really need it either.
I think for, you know, American cinema, we're so conditioned to see justice in the end. And we want a result, and we didn't really get that, so I can see why people felt, you know, unresolved.
What about
there.
The kid's response to going back to room? What about Jack? Was that successful to you? That he and what? How he felt and what he said?
I liked it because it was kind of a great bookend to his character. The first thing we see in the film, he's saying hello to different objects in the room, and then we see him say goodbye. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, he still sees the room as a room. Like, his perspective didn't really change.
Right.
Yeah. Well, he'll leave room where it was. I don't know if he'll leave room. But,
and that's okay.
Yeah. It's like just moving to another house.
but I got the sense that his perspective did change. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's outside playing with dogs and kids, and he's playing kickball and soccer. Mm-hmm. I mean, his room, his world has just opened up. Mm-hmm. So him saying goodbye is like... it's not like, you know, he was saying goodbye to his favorite vacation place. Mm-hmm. He was like, goodbye, I'm done with you. Done. I'm, you know, I'm on to...
You do get the sense that he's going to be fine.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you also go, Mom, I'm not so sure about this. It's going to take a long time.
Mm-hmm. It could take, but I did see that there was a reconnect. Mm-hmm. There was a connection, a disconnect, and then you can see that there was a reconnect, that she was going to end up fighting for her life, regardless of whether it's years of therapy, whatever, she was going to be with her child and love her child and take care of her child and fight for that. That's what I've got, anyways.
That's what she did all along.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, I did find that it was interesting that it was filmed in Toronto, 49 days to film. That's I found that pretty cool. The other thing I found really interesting, because we just talked about Brooklyn.
Right.
And we're talking about the movie Brooklyn. And we're talking about production budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you haven't done your research already, which one cost more?
I forgot already what Brooklyn was. I think that was $11 million, wasn't it?
Yeah, this was like 15.
Six. Well, I have six.
For this?
Yeah. What do you guys have?
I didn't look it up.
Wow. No,
I didn't get that one.
I had like 13 and Brooklyn was 11. Like this was $2 million more. $6 million is what it's done thus far.
No, I have
Canadian or American?
Well, I don't know.
Well, it's very interesting that you say
PNA
that.
What?
Huh?
Does that include
PNA?
That doesn't include the PNA, but it was released by A24, who I love. I've talked about this. I've talked about this company on this program before. A24, keep it up. You continue to release bold films. You continue to release these small movies where nobody in today's tentpole world, you're making it work. You're bringing smaller budgeted features like Ex Machina, like into the marketplace. And you're finding audience. You're proving that good cinema can play in a similar sandbox as all of these tentpoles. So I have to give A24 yet again another shout out, because I think that it's very important that we don't lose these smaller middle films, which the bigger studios are putting this push and they're shying away from these medium to lower budgeted films. So I like that, you know, you're putting $11, $12, $13 million or even less in your
somewhere between six
movies.
And 15 that we can we're very
American
close
and or
that,
Canadian.
Yeah, we
dollars.
Got that handled. So
yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because it was the like Brooklyn, it was funded from like all over the place.
Right.
They got much funding. I believe Donahue is a Canadian. She has dual citizenship.
Irish Canadian,
which helped because they were funded by a little bit of both there. And they got all these folks on. So I find that it's interesting how scrapping for money to make a movie. And what you said earlier, it is interesting that this movie got made considering the subject matter.
Yeah.
You know? It's pretty bold, you know, to do that in this day and age.
See, also, and to that when this book came out, because she is Irish Canadian, there were like book clubs that were talking about this book when it was first released, and it was only released back in 2011, so not that long ago. If you're going to put a timestamp on it,
just
so
in terms of numbers, it wasn't a huge success, but it had, you know, critical acclaim.
So, but like when the book was released, a lot of people were talking about it. So it makes sense that it would still get that the same people who were following the book to follow the movie.
I agree.
We haven't talked about, well, we have a little bit, but let's go into the acting a little bit more. Brie Larson, obviously, we had other people who were up for the role.
Shailene Woodley,
who I think would have been really good,
been
too.
Very interesting.
I think she would have been really good.
Emma Watson, Rooney Mara.
I think it would be interesting if Shailene Woodley, I mean, granted, Shailene and Brie Larson, they really aren't that far apart in age, too, but I feel like Shailene Woodley's, because of her physical attributes, I mean, she's beautiful, too, but she still looks a little too young to play a mother type of role.
Which would have been interesting. I think that would have been, to have a younger looking woman play that would have been fine. That would have made it even weirder.
Here's
a teenager having a kid.
I'm a big fan of Shailene Woodley. I think she would have, I think she's very, very talented. I think she would have been fine. I think Brie Larson does an exceptional job, don't get me wrong, but we were talking about Saoirse Ronan. Like, I don't see anybody else playing that role in Brooklyn other than her. With Brie Larson, she is strong. I'm not taking away. But had Shailene been in that role, like, I would have been, I think Shailene would have done some great things with that role as well. But unfortunately, this is what we get, and I'm not complaining about it.
I think it would have just been a different type of movie.
So, and you had some info on how she got the role, right? It was the performance in the audition. They were saying that she, when she was acting, it was as if she was really talking to a child that was she was acting against.
In her audition tapes, you can see the child, but there was no child. She's chatting away to her son, and it was actually the director who she was speaking to. And so this is
she created it so compellingly that anybody watching the audition thought she was actually speaking to a child.
Yeah, and they talked about how her warmth and playfulness was really apparent, and they wanted someone who could do comedy. Mm-hmm. Because this is a hilarious movie. No, because we need that sort of human warmth and naturalness. We need to feel that this is like the girl next door who got kidnapped, who's become something extraordinary.
Well, I said from the top, her mother instincts shine through in this.
Yes, you did.
She'll make a great mom. I believed her as a mom with all the protectiveness and what's important to the kid and taking care of Jack. I believe.
And the deception. And no matter what I mean by that, just the sleight of hand, just, everything's fine here. We're eggshells. We're making,
look at that, we're making a
snake. And just making a game out of it and trying, like, it reminded me, in a sense, of A Beautiful Mind. Not A Beautiful Mind, I'm sorry. What was the one with Bernie? What's his name? The Italian film. He goes to the, he takes
his
kid.
A Beautiful Life.
A Beautiful Life. Thank you. Yes.
Life is beautiful.
He's doing everything he can not to have his child see the horrors of what's in front of him.
Yes.
And it just reminded me of that same kind of distraction that he's going on here, doesn't want him to know the horrible thing that's happening, wanted to create a different world. Mm-hmm. I just thought in a totally different scale.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also the director, Lenny Abramson, saw Brie Larson in the movie Short Term 12. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that film, which was brilliant, by the way. You have to go see it.
Oh, another one we're going to be doing a podcast on. I'm feeling
we should. We should go back and talk about that movie. Mm-hmm. I saw that movie a few years ago, and so when I saw Brie Larson in this film, I was like, yes, absolutely, because her performance in Short Term 12, her character deals with a lot of children who've had troubled, broken families and bad past, history and whatnot. So just seeing Brie Larson's performance in that film, I know she can really connect to the younger audience. And so I believe the whole relationship between her as a mother to a son, because she has that warmth and she can get real with people who are so young but still connect in a way. So.
It seems to be a pattern with her roles. Even in Trainwreck, she's a mom and she's
to her sister.
To her sister,
to some degree.
Yeah, she's but the complete opposite in Scott Pilgrim Saves the World.
That's true.
So.
But I'm glad that she got the role. I mean, she, as you said, she'd spoken to trauma experts and nutritionists and allowed herself to be, I guess, isolated for about a month or something like that.
Yeah.
On a strict diet so she could get what it's like to be.
Makeup.
At confinement. Didn't have any makeup on set and made sure she didn't wash her face on set so you could see it. Everything like that. So,
Yeah, and I watched an interview with Brie Larson talking about her process of isolating herself, because she stayed at home for a month, didn't interact with anyone, didn't have internet, she talked to a nutritionist so she can have proper diet, but she felt that there was a point where she got to that all she did was cry, because she didn't have interactions with people. She got to the point where she felt so depressed that all she did was cry. And she related that to the book, because apparently there's a moment in the book where for the first 2 years, Ma is by herself, and all she did was cry to the point where she couldn't cry anymore. And then when she found out that she was pregnant, she now had a reason to live for.
And another reason to cry.
And so that's what Brie also, connected to with her performance.
Well, that was another... You bring up an interesting point, too, that, again, this is one of those directions that book and or movie could have gone. I mean, there are some conventions that would say she would grow up hating the child.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's, she could say with argument that, it's really not her child. It was so it's interesting the path that book and movie, they just throw that stuff out. They don't go down that road at all. It's her child. She's caring for
that child. If you're telling a book, a story about the time that, I guess, what's the word? I guess the pulling away from the mother. It's a story about a child pulling away from the mother and that time that has to occur, that occurs with everybody. Then, you have to have her accept the child from the beginning in order to have that story be told.
Yeah.
So that's a given if that's what the story you want to tell. And apparently that's what she always wanted to write about, Emma Donahue, was that she wanted to write specifically about a child having to pull away from the mother. Am I getting that right?
At the heart of this novel is a celebration both of parental love and of the resilience and resources of childhood. Mm.
Mm. So maybe not so much.
But also that, you know, the definitely that was part of it. But you know, in that resilience and resources of childhood is that process.
Yeah.
You know, that's the bigger picture, but the process of pulling away and becoming one's own self is absolutely one of the themes.
And that's very interesting. And I also like the belief that we can believe the mother and the son being so close, because had that relationship not been established and had been so strong, I don't believe Ma could have survived in that room for so long.
Right.
I think she would have killed herself way earlier in the story.
Yeah, it would have been a completely different movie, you know, had one elected to write a book that way. You know, so, but we wanted to talk about other performances.
Tremblay's
performance.
I love that he was just gotten out of an audition. It was, I mean, an exhaustive search.
Yeah, he was, I mean, obviously at the end of the search, because they stopped searching when they found him. But there was big concern that they were not going to find a child who could do the role, who could have the right look and do the role.
Yeah, always.
And it was an audition.
And then there's all those other things too. I mean, even think about, they have to get the right age, because if you get them slightly too old, Tammy, you said something.
They have teeth. They have big teeth. They still have to have baby teeth if you're playing 5 years old.
Yeah, I was like, I didn't even thought of that. But of course, oh my God.
And it was getting him to, again, I think it was getting him to act.
Yeah.
Like getting him to yell at Brie Larson for a candle, which he couldn't. He wasn't pulling off, or he didn't want to do. Seven.
Yeah.
And, you know, but they had the whole cast and crew was like yelling and screaming, and he was forced to yell at, I want my candles, you know, and so that's how you coax a performance out of, that's what's working with child actors.
I want to see the outtake
actors.
Of that. Huh? I want to see the outtake of that. That would be interesting to see.
Go ahead. Oh, sorry. Lenny Abramson, the director, also said the age 5 is such a key important part too, because he says, and I quote, 5 is important not because he's not a baby anymore, but you're still a baby. So like, you have that dual duality there, and to talk about Jacob, he says he's old enough to do the amazing things he does, but not old enough to escape the fantasy of that world of room. Yeah. I was like, yeah, he definitely conveyed that.
Absolutely.
I thought, for me, one of the best things about his performance was when he was so scared about having to do the escape part of it.
Right.
It's just, you know, because on one level I'm going, just, no, don't. It's too much. But no, you have to.
Yeah.
It was just great.
It was terrifying.
It was wonderful. Very well done, if you ask me.
Yeah.
I think the reveal when he finally released himself from the wreck in the truck, just that quick shot of, you know, seeing the world for the first time, I thought that was just beautifully shot, as simple as it was.
Overwhelming, though.
Yeah. Overwhelming.
Get up, run, get up!
Get out and run. But it was like, there was that moment where he lost himself and kind of forgot what he was supposed to do, because he was just amazed and overwhelmed by everything.
Yeah. One of the other things that I read that Abramson talked about was that you can't, it's a sort of a careful balance when you're working with children, because you can see them acting. I mean, it's true with anyone. You can really see it in their eyes, you know, and he was saying if you don't do it a certain way, the eyes aren't right. But he says, the way I describe it is, there has to have been a time in Tiger Woods' life where he'd never held a golf club before, you know? And so that, you know, the before and after, the, you know, the in room and out of room, and all the discovery that continues for Jack through the entire thing, inside and outside of the room.
Mm-hmm. We should also talk about Joan Allen. She's good to see her.
Yeah, I thought it was great to see her. I haven't seen her in seemingly forever.
Well, like the last thing I remember seeing her in was, I don't know which one was, The Upside of Anger or The Last Born Ultimatum. I can't remember which one was later, but that's the last one I remember.
It's been a long time.
Fabulous in Upside Anger.
She's great.
And it was great to see her in this movie. And again, it's one of those things where, I had no idea. I had no idea that both she and William H. Macy were in this movie.
Again, for the third time.
Yeah, so, but when he pops up, and again, it was one of those things that sort of took me out of the movie. Like, had I known, had I known that they were in the movie, I would have been okay. But then I was like, wait, that's Joan Allen? I haven't seen her. William H. Macy's in this movie? And that's what I said. I go, William H. Macy's in this movie? So it took me out of the movie for a little bit for me not knowing.
Yeah.
Because it was a surprise.
But I think that, you know, interestingly enough, the one criticism that I've read about the performances was about William H. Macy. Like, he was they were saying that thankless. I don't know if it was his performance so much or the role
character
that was written for him. I'm going,
yeah.
I found nothing wrong with it. I thought, I get why they split up. It happens a lot.
Yeah.
A child either dies, goes missing, whatever it is, and sometimes marriage can't survive. I get it.
Yep.
And then he came back and he couldn't. How many times have I seen that in real life where, you know, something traumatic happens to the reason why you have a grandson, let's put it that way, you're not ready to deal with yet. You can't figure it out. You can't, because every time you see that child, you're thinking of the perpetrator.
Right.
Yeah. I get it.
No, I got that too.
I don't know why, but that was the only, and I read it on more than one, and I was like, why are they having issues with that? That seems perfectly honest and real.
Yeah, it's an interesting subject, because there was this other movie that came out some years ago called Rabbit Hole.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Which is a fair, that does not end on such a hopeful note as this, but it's a very depressing, but it talks about, you know, the tragedy of the loss of a child, what it does to what it can do to a marriage, what obviously this did to a marriage, and yet, you know, people didn't buy it in with Han and Leia in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. They didn't buy that they split up because they lost their son. And I'm like, but we've seen a ton of movies that joke.
But they didn't have the force.
Yeah, I guess. But it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't.
But I just find it very interesting. But I liked William H. Macy's performance. I agree with you 100%. I found it to be, I get it.
I found it was very believable. I think I was more upset at the fact that we didn't get enough of him. I was more upset at that. Yeah,
Liked it because I'm thinking, oh my God, he's gonna come back. They're not gonna reunite or anything, but they're gonna. But then when he left,
he's gone.
He's gone,
which was great because then you're left with this guy who is I don't remember. Lee, I think is his name, the character,
the
name?
Friend,
the friend. And then because I don't have any awareness of him.
Right.
I have no history. I don't know the actor. I don't know anything. I went, then I just have to take him as he is, as opposed to somebody I know with the pedigree of William H. Macy. And I went, that was brilliant. Because then I had to take him like Jack had to take him.
Right.
I don't have any history either with this guy.
Yeah.
And neither did Jack.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that makes sense then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I liked what the friend brought to, you know, just that relationship of Jack growing up in the world again. Because this is probably the only other man that has been introduced to his life. And I was glad that the friend was a positive influence on him rather than a negative one.
And again, a very plain looking guy, like nothing, you know, he's just average looking, no disrespect to the actor, but I'm just saying that, I found that to your point too, having that actor choosing him and how he was portrayed, I think really helps Jack's well-being in the end.
It was important for Jack to have, you know, come back again with another male in his life that ended on a better note.
Right.
Well, I'm going to put this in front of everybody and you guys talk about this. Music. Go ahead. For those of you who listened before, you understand what that means. Why don't you guys?
The music, Stephen Renix did composed the original music for this film. And Brie Larson already has a established career as a musician. She's sold songs and records and whatnot, so she even sang the Big Rock Candy Mountain by herself.
Yeah.
Like, that was a real recording of her.
That was great.
I noticed the music, especially when Jack was in the truck and he was rolling out of the rug and he saw the world for the first time. I really felt it there. And it was so telling because when we were in the room, there really wasn't any music. But when he was out in the world, there was.
Yeah, I mean, I find that, it interesting. Go ahead.
Is that was your memory?
Well, you know, according to Steven, his challenge here for Room was creating something that recognizes the child's perspective, and whether it be the balance between naivety and hope, and then longing and sadness. And I didn't find the score to be like overbearing. Mm-hmm. It didn't steal scenes. I thought it was a good bed for you know, it helped bring out some emotion. It helped, you know, but it didn't force me to have emotion. Mm-hmm. But it played along with the movie in which it complemented what was going on, so that the emotions are more real and true. So I found the
score beautiful. That's what a score is supposed to do. You know,
would hope.
Mm-hmm. There's very little actual criticism about this movie. I found as I was looking around, you know, and reading comments and things. But actually, the one criticism I read was somebody said the music was crap. And I don't have that experience. But their conversation was that it was overused and overbearing and too heavily laid in. Which I don't think anybody on this panel agrees with,
so.
But just to give voice to a criticism that I didn't read, because there are very few of them.
Were they deaf?
Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe. Or maybe they had the volume up too loud, the balance was out.
I don't know.
Do you think Emma did a fine job converting her book to the screen?
Well, we didn't read it, but I have a few things to say about that.
Okay.
Do you know? Okay, so she wrote the screenplay as well as the book, and do you know that she wrote the screenplay before the book was published?
I did not know that.
Interesting.
Yes.
So she always wanted it filmed.
Yes. She believed so much in the story that she wrote the screenplay first. This is her first screenplay that has been produced. Mm-hmm. She's written others, but she had such
short, I believe, called Pluck or something like that. But go ahead.
She had such belief in the story that she wrote the screenplay before the book came out, and she didn't want to come. She, you know, because when you write a book and if it is successful, invariably the production companies come in and say, we would like to adapt your book. And she didn't want someone to come in and say, you know what, we got this. We've got this already figured out. Mm-hmm. And she wrote the screenplay, or the first draft of the screenplay, with the thought that when I do find a film company that wants to make this, I'm not going to force them to use me as a writer, but at least, you know,
they'll know my vision as how I would see it on the screen.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then case in point, when Lenny Abramson, he pitched himself.
Right.
He read the book and sent her a very impassioned letter.
10-page letter.
Well, he goes on to say there was more like 5. In an interview,
she says 10.
Because the story goes that you
so
read
much
the novel
like our budget.
Was a
10-page letter. Well, I have the quote on the budget in a second. He goes, I think it was 5 pages, but in America, double spacing is considered standard. So let's say 10.
That's funny.
So, but it was very interesting that, you know, within that he you know, quoted things like Plato's Room. But he, this is what I love, he also dissed other filmmakers. Saying, you know, you don't want a filmmaker say like that to do this. Like, he was really campaigning for himself, and he put it out there that nobody but him. He goes, other filmmakers such as will come and, you know, they'll pitch. He goes, but this is my vision of this movie. This is how I want to do it, and I think we can do it. And it took her. It took her a while. I mean, this didn't happen overnight. You know, well over a year before she decided upon, he's going to have my vision, because studios, like you said, were trying to come in and they wanted to take it away, you know, take away the control, or they wanted to make it their own. A lot of people couldn't believe that you could have half of a movie stuck in a room. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to change that as well. Yeah. And so she held on to that, that 5 or 10 page letter, depending on the spacing. And she finally said, you know what? Mm-hmm. I do agree that you're going to be the person to do it. They funded it independently. Mm-hmm. A24 comes on board, and they gave some notes as well, but they more or less, they liked what they had.
She stayed on as writer, which is not always the case either.
Yeah, and they worked on the script together, the two of them.
Yeah, collaborative effort.
Well, plus being that she brought in some of the funding.
Yeah, that always helps.
I got some money here.
Okay.
Get the purse strings.
I said yes because he wrote me a letter as brilliant as it was courageous in putting his cards on the table, a letter that let me glimpse the masterpiece that he would make of Room. And she actually says, no Hollywood gush, I can't spend 5 minutes with a man without laughing. So this idea of him, you know, he didn't build himself up and didn't, you know, go, I'm your man because I've done this and list off his resume and that sort of
which
thing.
Which he doesn't have, but a huge resume.
Right. But he did.
Frank.
Well, she said it was, he believes that Frank may have been the linchpin because it at least had actors that are recognizable in it. That's what he sort of believes that, you know, I did Frank. I went and did other projects in the meantime, and Frank, I think, was the one that she took seriously and said, you know, and he has a, you know, he obviously has a vision. And ultimately, again, I think everything in this movie was the right choice, whomever they picked for
except
director.
Maybe Shailene Woodley.
Listen, I'm just saying she would have done a good job. But I mean, from, you know, everybody they picked, from production design to editing to music to writing to directing to the casting, you know, this is a movie where all that clicks and very well in very fine fashion.
One more quote I have from Emma. She says, I've learned not to get obsessed with the actual dialogue and screenplay, the spoken words, which I think happens a lot. The opposite happens with writers, you know.
Damn it,
they cut my very last word. She says that's just one aspect of the film, and there's a lot more to it than the words.
Right.
Yeah. I want to know what you, Mr. Writer, thought about the writing.
Long pause.
Well, you know,
do we need some filler music? What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. What I thought about it. Well. You know, the structure is interesting. I like that it took chances with structure. I like that they chose not to go voiceover. I mean, there's so many things that we've already talked about that we've already talked about in terms of script. That's just why I'm trying to figure out what happened we already talked about.
Right.
So I appreciated that. And I agree with her in terms of sensibility. I'm not really precious about anything I write either, as long as they get the tone right or the sense of it. I don't really care about the actual dialogue unless it pertains to plot and we need it.
Yeah.
So I agree with all those things. I'm surprised and grateful that they continued that they chose to have her write her own material, and I think it was a great exercise for her to go from one medium to another. And congratulations that she did it successfully. So, for that, for those things and everything we've already talked about, I think she kudos to her.
Yeah.
She saved money, and at the same time, she paid bills.
Well, exactly. And I think, sort of speaking to your point of wrapping it all up about how it really worked, is that it appears that this was a great collaboration on in so many of the departments. You know, the she talks about how Emma talks about how, you know, the producers did not come in and say, you have to and you can't and, you know, this kind of thing. They really let the collaboration, they trusted them to collaborate and create something that ended up working out really well.
Yeah.
And I think they're very lucky.
And I think for a movie that could have been, it seems simple on the surface, but for a somewhat simple movie, it could have been really boring. It could have been really slow. Being stuck in one location for half of a movie, the audience could already potentially feel the tiredness of that.
The tediousness.
And I think
and some degree you have to. You want them to feel that because how else are you going to
relate? How else are you going
to
get that
careful balance of to the point of checking out?
Yeah, exactly. It's
but
very
I
difficult.
Feel like the pacing was still great because not once was I ever bored. I watched this movie twice and I still got a lot out of it. For every day that they were at their room, I was like, okay, what's going to happen today? I want to know, like, how they deal on a daily basis. And we saw that, but not once was I ever bored. And even when they got out into the world, just how are they going to react to, like, certain situations? Like, I thought it was still compelling through and through.
Yeah. So, just going back, so it was the LA Times, great article. With indie films such as Brooklyn and Room, the creativity often begins with financing. In the opening paragraph, Brooklyn cost $11 million, Room had $13 million budget. Mm-hmm. So, unless they could be wrong, LA Times, it's happened before, but I found it very surprising that Room cost $2 million more than Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just found it that it was more that it cost more than Brooklyn. Period. Even if it was a million,
I'm surprised. I'm by
like
that
Brooklyn,
too. Which is why I believe the $6 million. I went, wow, that's cheap. But then when we because we talked Brooklyn and it made sense.
Yeah.
But also, again, Brooklyn went
so many crew
too.
Members, 49-day shoot. It's going to take longer because you've got a child. So that's probably why the cost would have been more.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have a longer shoot.
Damn kids.
That's true. Well, maybe the soundstage, too.
Yeah, that's what I mean, the build and stuff like that.
So there was one interesting little movie miracle that happened on set. For the final scene, they wanted snow. And they couldn't
talk about expensive.
They didn't have it. Well, they didn't have it in the budget for snow. They just couldn't do it, and it just happened that and that snow, day. Like they got their snow.
It's a Christmas room miracle.
Now you know something interesting. I want to point out to the art room, the artwork here, some of the key art here. So. I like it. It's very simple, and it's, you know, you get the spacious sky and room, this big room. But if you take out room, it looks, doesn't it look a little bit like the poster, or at least part of the poster from Boyhood, looking up at the sky?
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
It's the shot through the skylight.
But also, I think, too, the creative artwork, not the one right behind us, but the promotional posters that you see mine and Jack hugging on the promo posters is that there's the sky behind them, but you can also see the faint line of a room corner. And I thought that was so brilliant. It's so simple because they are technically in a room in the world, but also mentally as well.
So, and we haven't talked really a little bit about reception. It's dollars and such. So the movie, it opened up, as you said, you saw it in October. It opened up on October 16th. And when it opened up, it was only in four theaters. Ranked number 31, but since it is its widest release at 293 cinemas or locations, we'll say, it's to date it's grossed an estimated at least $6.2 million. It's probably a little bit higher counting today's gross, perhaps. So it's very interesting. This again, you know, being nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, that'll help.
Well, you know, it's
and Brie Larson winning Golden Globe.
Again, though, it goes to, you know, I don't know. Again, picking the director, to me, there just seems something fishy. I mean, having the director nominated for Best Director over, like, say, Ridley Scott, I'm trying to figure out what, like, it just seems, interesting because, you know, we've got a movie that thus far, I mean, it could end up, if it wins Best Picture, it would be probably next to Hurt Locker. I forget how much Hurt Locker made, but right now Hurt Locker is the movie that won Best Picture with that had the smallest, least amount of gross. So,
well,
which is
if
very
we look at the, you know, we've talked about how the whole movie hinges on their performances, and he was the director was largely instrumental in casting them, obviously, and getting their performances out of them. So then he did his job.
I just find that if this movie were five categories, if I'm just wondering.
By the way, I don't disagree because I think Ridley Scott should get
enough.
You know, but its reception, critic wise, 96% on Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah. What's even more astounding.
I'm surprised.
I am too.
What's even more astounding to me, there is no cinema score because it's just not wide enough a movie for them to survey. But if you go by Rotten Tomatoes, if you take it with a grain of salt, 95% Rotten Tomatoes users. So
I was surprised the critics liked it as much, and then more surprised that audiences did. Honestly, I didn't think it was. It's not like I thought people would hate this. I just didn't think they would give it that high of a score. And then Metacritic gives an 8.3 or an 8.6 or something like that. And you know, even IMDb gives it an 8.9 stuff like that. So
I gave it a high rating.
Would you give it that high of a rating?
I would, yes, but I agree with you. I'm surprised that audiences like it so much.
Yeah,
because it doesn't seem like a big audience pleaser.
No, it doesn't.
I think it's also the content that not a lot of people would gravitate towards such a somewhat traumatic type of storyline.
Well, this is why I say you take Rotten Tomatoes with a grain of salt. This is me putting on my cynical hat. 95% to me seems like an exceptionally high number for a movie that's only yet done $6 million and it's been released since October. It's not uncommon, and, you know, whether it's a Hollywood secret or not, the publicity machines at the studios ping Rotten Tomatoes. They
Wait,
have people
what?
Ping it. So,
what?
You know, that's why I'm like, you know, when you're only in 294 locations with the 6 million, that's not an awful lot of, when you break it down, it's not an awful lot of people who are going or able to find the movie.
Right.
You know, I mean, I know that there is a lot of buzz, and probably after the Golden Globes, you know, there could have been an uptick in gross. But I did, you know, the critic response, I'm not surprised at all.
I'm just saying that because it's universally liked. Almost. I mean, I found one negative review.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm just surprised that it got as high as it did critically. Yeah. I'm not saying it's not deserving it. I'm just surprised by it because, well, I guess I am saying that because I didn't think all critics would go for it.
Yeah, I mean, this movie was getting great positive reviews from the start because even at the Toronto International Film Festival, it won People's Choice Award. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and then even Brie Larson won an award for like best performance for an actress at that film festival. Yeah.
Well, do you want to know the breakdown? The actual breakdown on Rotten Tomatoes, out of 184 reviews counted, 177 were positive. Fresh and 7 were rotten, which that's a high thing, and I can't even even at the Room, though an improvement on the source novel, remains a prisoner of its limited point of view. That comes from Ed Whitfield of Outre. You know, if Outre can get on there, so can't Anatomy of a Movie, Rotten Tomatoes. What the hell is Outre? I'm sorry,
but even
what is that?
So. It doesn't matter.
But we should be on that. That's my point.
But then you've got Richard Roper saying things, the most impressive piece of filmmaking I've seen in 2015, one of the best movies in the decade.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah, heavy hitters giving it high praise.
I'm just really happy that it's now generating buzz and getting positive reception that it should be getting for such a small movie. I'm glad the word is starting to actually get out there because it does deserve, recognition, and it's finally getting it.
All right, well, we got to finish up. So here, what are our last thoughts? Anything we covered, anything we haven't covered that you want to talk about? Anything, any of your research that you want to bring up?
Let's see.
I think we got everything.
All right, Dimitri, let's do with last thoughts.
Last thoughts, like I said, I think this is a solid piece of work. I think it's a solid piece of filmmaking that you should see. I mean, if you're going to be because of the Golden Globes curious of Brie Larson and what she's capable of doing, go see this movie. Yeah. You won't be disappointed. She does deliver the goods. That's not all just publicity. And it's a strong film. My only thing is it necessarily best picture of the year? I don't know. Best director of the year? Not for me. That's just for me.
Tim?
I think it's a well-crafted film. It's a compelling story, beautifully told, and I definitely, left it with an interesting perspective that I couldn't have gotten, in other ways. Let's hope. And I really appreciated it. I really appreciated the filmmaking. And I recommend it.
Yes, I highly recommended this movie.
We know
and
that.
From
the very beginning. I will tell everyone to go see Short Term 12, which Brie Larson's also in. She should have been nominated earlier, years ago, for that role. Go see that film. And this film, I loved it so much. And I love character strength. And seeing stories that people who can prevail during like such hardships, and to end this type of movie on a positive note, as much darkness and sadness there is in the world, there's always a light somewhere.
If it didn't end on at least somewhat of a hopeful note, I really would.
You are not European.
Then I might not have recommended this movie.
I would get it, but that's not where
not
I'm
only
to
did
right
it
now.
Not get his comeuppance, but this ended on a down note. Why did I bother?
And I think that the story was beautifully told, and the performances were beautifully there and acted. And I'm glad that we finally got to talk about this film.
There you go. And congratulations.
Your thoughts, John?
Just glad it was made and glad I saw it. Dimitri, where can they find you?
Glad I saw it. There you go. You can please support me on Twitter at DMovies1701.
Tamara.
I am at Tamara Berg on Twitter, and my website is TamaraCentral.com.
Marissa.
Follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV.
And you can find me right here at the Popcorn Talk Network on Anatomy of a Movie. Check out our other Popcorn Talk shows. We got Box Office Breakdown, DC Comic News, Marvel,
News.
Jedi Alliance.
Yeah, just a ton of things. All movies, all the time. everything for you to, I mean, everything and anything that you might want to talk about in terms of movies, check that out, PopCornTalk.network. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Bye, folks.
You have a website? That's awesome.
Yes, of course.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.